Okay. All right, my name is Ben Lauder. I'm the vice chair of the Central Region RAC. Chris Marble is our chair, but he had a family emergency tonight and could not be here, so I'll be stepping in for him. And maybe winging a little bit, so bear with me, but we'll get through it. Thank you to the audience and to the DWR members that are here for your coming out tonight and participating in this process. In my opinion, it's one of the best processes we have in the United States here, so as far as making wildlife-related decisions. Go over the format of the meeting real quick. Typically, these meetings run, we start with a presentation from a member of the DWR. They'll present their recommendations. Help me out here, Jason, if I get this wrong. We go at that point to question from the RAC, and then we'll take questions from the audience, from the public, after which we will take feedback from the public. If you want to comment, I need one of these yellow comment cards filled out and brought up here. We'll call you up. You'll have 3 minutes if you're representing yourself, 5 minutes if you're representing an organization, at which point, after we've heard public comment, the RAC will discuss and we'll vote on stuff. All right. Agenda doesn't look too bad tonight. Let's start with the approval of the agenda and the minutes. If anybody would like to make that motion.
I'll make a motion we accept the minutes and the agenda.
Thank you, Ken. Second? Anybody? Mike? All right, so we have a motion by Ken and a second by Mike to approve the agenda and the minutes. All in favor? Okay. Any opposed? All right. Passed with two abstentions from Christine and Danny. All right. On to the Wildlife Board meeting update. I was unable to attend the Wildlife Board meeting, so I'm going to go over the motions that were made. I have a list of them, and we do have a board member here, Carl Hurst, who, Carl, feel free to step in and clarify or add as you see fit. There was quite a long agenda. We were here very late at the last meeting. So let's see as we go through these. I see there was an action item addressed to address archery season dates for elk. And then they moved on to the statewide mountain goat management plan that was passed with a vote of 5 and 1 abstention from Kevin Albrecht. And then they moved on to the Bighorn Sheep Management Plan. There were 2 motions on that. One motion was to approve the plan, and that was approved. And then there was another motion, and I'll read this motion. Motion to add to the action log that the division give a progress report on the management plan's lethal removal process and MOU at every board meeting until it is completed. And that passed as well. So I imagine we'll hear updates from that as well from the board meetings. Please.
Some of you that have been involved in the sheep understand that there is some difficulty between the agriculture group and the sportsmen. It has been kind of came to a head with the mineral. I would like to applaud both groups in that for the way that they addressed that, came together, put together a plan. There are 2 of the things that are kind of left out of that plan, or at least in the process. One's an MOU with the agriculture and the sportsmen, and one is a lethal removal protocol. And that motion was, we feel that that is very important to get that moving, to keep it moving, and so that's why they'll be reporting every board meeting to us until we get that done. But that is a game-changing agreement, and that is a game-changing plan to have in place.
Thanks for the additional context there, Carl. As a member of that committee, that was a big item of discussion, and the committee felt that that was important as well. So we're glad that the Wildlife Board recognized that and is moving forward with that as well. Okay, looks like their next motion was to add to the action log that the division attempt to define a primitive weapon hunt and have the board review it at the April meeting. That passed. If you recall, we had some discussion. What's that? Yeah. Yeah, we had some discussion at our last meeting about a definition for primitive weapons, which currently doesn't exist. That was a recommendation brought by SFW. I believe we as a RAC were in favor of, I believe we made a motion to ask the board to ask the DWR to address that. So had good representation there, apparently. Okay, there was also a recommendation here at the Central RAC for concerning the Barney Top limited entry archery only elk hunt. There was a motion on that at the Wildlife Board that failed. And then a follow-up motion to have the DWR review that proposal, and that passed. Moving on, they another recommendation that I recall from SFW was and partnering organizations was to add two new archery limited entry sheep hunts on the Newfoundland Mountains and the Zion Mountains. There was a motion made on that, and that passed as well. So two new sheep hunts. Okay, moving on. If you recall, we also addressed an issue that was brought to us by John Baer concerning spike elk hunting in the state of Utah, and we sent a motion to the board to let them know we were not in favor of reducing spike elk hunting opportunities. Don't believe they addressed that, but they did address, they did add the spike only rifle hunt back to the Monroe unit. That was a motion that also passed. So I think we were heard. Carl, do you have anything to add to that? I'm curious.
There was not a motion on the spike elk hunt just because we left it alone. And so it is just like it was, but we did add the Monroe back in. And the discussion was, if it's going to be on somebody's favorite unit and not on another, it ought to be fair. So it's going to be statewide now.
Okay. Thanks, Carl. And I applaud the board for that as well. Okay. Carl, I may need you up here again. There was this motion fell. There was a motion to not approve the early rifle hunt on the Panguitch Lake unit that failed. Does anybody have any questions on that? Yeah, I think we're good. Also a motion to approve extending the east boundary of the extended archery unit of the Green River as proposed by the DWR. That passed.
One to back up a little bit, they did approve, didn't they, the early rifle hunt then, didn't they?
I think they did not get rid of it, so it's still in place. It was another not in our backyard thing. And I listened.
Well, they were going to put an early rifle hunt. They were going to split early and late rifle hunt on the Panguitch.
Are we talking mountain, deer or elk?
Deer.
Okay.
And they do have an early rifle hunt there. The motion was to get rid of it, and they denied that motion. They kept it.
Okay.
And I believe Ken is talking about the Mount Dutton elk.
No, I'm talking about the deer.
Oh, are you?
The split season on the.
The comment in the board meeting and so forth was that there were people that were concerned that it was the time they were taking cattle off the mountain, and. But it came back, as I listened to the board meeting, the same discussion. If it's good for other units, it's good for the Panguitch, and they left that early season on there.
Okay, thanks for that clarification. Okay, there was a... Okay, at that point, there was a motion to approve the balance of the Bucks Bowls Once in a Lifetime, which passed. That's all the Bucks Bowls Once in a Lifetime. Then they moved on to CWMU management plan and permit numbers. There's a motion to accept the Mountain Meadows CWMU's late application, deer season date change, and deer permit reduction, and accept Double R's request to add an extra 15 days to their bull elk season date, and that passed. There was a motion to approve the balance of the CWMU management plans and permit numbers. That passed. They then addressed the dedicated hunter rule amendments. That passed as presented by the DWR. And then there was a motion to approve the 2019 waterfowl recommendations and rule as presented, with the caveat that electric bikes be limited to a class one bike as defined by state and federal regulations. And that passed. I do remember we had a handful of constituents that were here discussing electric bikes at our last meeting. I apologize for that. As a reminder, if you haven't silenced your phones yet, go ahead and do so. I lead by example. Let's see. And one last motion to approve the Flaming Gorge Reservoir Rule amendments as presented, and that passed. And then there's another note here that the chairman asked Dax Mangus, who is, I believe, regional manager in the Northeastern region, regional wildlife manager in the Northeastern region, to convene the necessary agencies and players to review the issues facing the Book Cliffs, namely habitat issues, and update the board during the April 2019 meeting. Any questions on the board review? If so, they'll go to Carl. All right, seeing none, regional update.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a few things really briefly this evening. One thing out of our habitat section, they've been working fast and furious on reseeding the fires on the south end of the county. We had several down there, as you know. Coal Hollow Fire is completed at this point, and that's... we put seed and chained that seed in the ground on that one. Hilltop Fire, they seeded and they were in the middle of chaining when the snow hit, so that chaining is postponed now due to the snow, but we'll get back on that when we can. And the Pole Creek Fire is scheduled to be finished this week with the seeding on the ground on that one, I think. So we're glad to get that done. We like the snow. We could have taken a couple more days without it to finish this up, but we'll take what we can get. From our outreach section, we have a waterfowl seminar this Saturday. And I believe, is that Cabela's, Scott, or is that? Oh, my, here in this room. So spread that word around for the seminar. We've had a couple of position changes in our region. Our wildlife recreation specialist recently changed positions, and she went up to the northern region into the aquatic section there. And we held interviews, and we hired Michael Packer as our wildlife recreation specialist. And that position is over our community fisheries throughout the region. We have 19 community fisheries, a walk-in access program, and some of the other events like the waterfowl seminar and those types of events. So we're excited to have Michael on with us. He's been with us for the last three seasons as a technician in our aquatic section. One other personnel change, Tom Becker, would you mind standing up for me? Tom Becker has been with the division for over 30 years-ish. I don't know if he'll tell us exactly how long, but...
Too long.
He's decided to retire, so 1982... So he's decided to retire. We're excited for him. He's been a biologist out in the Tooele and that district out there. He's been a great hand, a lot of experience right there. We're gonna hate to see him go, but we're excited for him as well. And I think he's excited to retire as well. So thank you, Tom, for all the years you've put in for the agency. And then just one final thing. We're in the middle of our wildlife captures throughout the state and within the region. I think we sent out some dates or some information on those wildlife captures to the RAC members. If you're interested in getting some experience or being in on those, contact myself or Riley. Those are going to be happening here in the next week, next 2 weeks, especially close here. So I think all those will be deer at this go around right now. So with that, unless there's any questions, I'll turn the time back over to the chair.
All right, thank you. And Tom, congratulations on the retirement. You will be missed. Okay, next up, 2019 Black Bear Recommendations and Rule Amendments. Darren, you're up.
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to present this tonight. Tonight we'll be looking at our bear recommendations for the upcoming season. I wanted to do a quick run-through of how we manage black bears in the state. First of all, the Division of Wildlife Resources mission statement is to serve the people of Utah as a trustee and guardian of the state's wildlife. We actively manage black bear populations in the state, and hunting is a key component in that management strategy. Having said that, we have a long history of managing bears in Utah, 51 years. They became a protected species in 1967. We managed for a long time with kind of a dearth of knowledge about what was going on with those populations. Beginning in the mid-80s, we started to do a lot of research on black bears in Utah, and in the late 90s, put together the first bear discussion group and drafted a black bear management plan that came out in 2000. That plan was updated in 2011 and is scheduled to run through the 2023 time frame. That plan has one primary goal, and that is to maintain a healthy bear population in existing occupied habitat, to expand distribution while considering human safety, economic concerns, and other wildlife species. And we define in the plan a healthy bear population as one with a proportion of breeding age animals that will maintain population levels consistent with habitat and also maintain genetic variability. So what does the black bear plan say? This plan is what we base all of these recommendations on. The first strategy in the plan and something I want to talk a little bit about tonight is that the plan recommends that we manage bears on 3-year harvest recommendation cycles. And so we would make recommendations. We would let those recommendations stay in place for 3 years. Then we would reevaluate in the third year. The reason that we do that is primarily because of black bear biology. First of all, black bears are long-lived. They can live to be, you know, into their 30s sometimes. They have a relatively low annual reproductive rate, especially compared to other mammals that we talk about, like deer and elk. They can sometimes go years without having cubs, and it depends a lot on the individual, but they tend to increase slowly. If they decline, they tend to decline slowly. And so you don't need to be making annual changes in order to manage black bears. You can take these longer slices and then make evaluations at the end of that period. That's why the plan has a 3-year recommendation cycle. There's some other concerns with annual changes. You know, one thing I'll show tonight is we try to use our indices to do a population reconstruction. That can be confounded if you're ramping up permits annually. It makes it look like there might be, it can make it look like there might be more bears in the population. And so we want to keep things consistent in terms of harvest during that time period, so we can be confident in our evaluation on population trend. And longer term stable management strategies are always a goal for us. It helps the public understand what the regulations are, and they're not changing every year, and so people can kind of get used to what's going on with management. So on those three-year cycles, these are the parameters that we use in order to make decisions about permits and seasons. We split bear management units into three categories: light, moderate, or liberal, depending on what our population objectives are for those units. Light harvest, goal there would be to allow a bear population to grow. Moderate typically is a maintenance level. Liberal harvest are units where we might be trying to actually reduce a bear population. Perhaps we've got concerns about livestock depredation or even crop depredation. They were trying to suppress those populations. Most of the units in the state, 13, fall into the moderate strategy. There are four that fall under light and six units that fall under the liberal harvest. And then we make adjustments based on what category they're in. You can see the model parameters, basically where the number of adult males that we see in the harvest and the number of females that we see in the harvest. And then we'll make recommendations for permits based on what those data show. One other thing that we did last year, when we took recommendations around, there were some discussions in the board about a few topics, and the board asked us to put together a discussion group to address those, specifically about hunting opportunities on the Bookcliffs and the LaSalle and San Juan units. That group met and had those discussions. We also talked about a few other things. We talked a little bit about spot and stock hunting during the fall. That would be basically a boot hunt where you couldn't use dogs or bait. You just have to, you could hunt bears, but you'd have to spot them and then stalk them on your own. We talked a little bit about bait stations and some of the requirements for registering those. We had a lot of discussions about non-resident pursuit during the spring seasons. And we had some livestock producers on that committee as well, and talked a little bit about their concerns. Some of the things that we discussed, you'll see, will make it into these recommendations. Other things we discussed, but after we finished, decided we wouldn't make adjustments at this time. So you'll see that. This is a list of people who were represented on the on that committee groups. So into the data now. Here you have the last 5 years of statewide bear success, and also the number of bears that have been harvested in each year. A little bit of a reduction, both in success and harvest, between 2017 and 18, but still more than what we saw in the previous 3 years. This is how that looks on a graph. So the red line are the number of bears that were harvested, and the orange line are the number of permits that have been issued over time since about 1990. You can see in 2011, if you remember, the first year of the bear management plan, if you look, you can see there's a three-year window when things were consistent. Permits remained the same. And then there was an adjustment on that third year. The way the plan's written, we should have continued that, and we haven't. You can see we've continued to raise permits. I talked a little bit earlier about a population reconstruction. I think we've had this discussion before, but just quickly to kind of remind everyone, if you look at the ages of bears that are harvested in a given year, you can back calculate. So, for example, you have 4 or 5 year olds in the harvest. You know that you had at least four-year-olds the year before, and you can kind of go back that way. And if you just look at the adult portion of the population, you can get a trend over time in the population. Don't get too hung up on the total number. This is an absolute minimum. This doesn't take into account natural mortality. This is all based on hunting mortality. But it does give you a good idea of what the trend for bears statewide has been over time. You can see there's probably been, over the last 3 years or so, a leveling off in our bear population trend. Depredation. One thing that can sometimes limit us socially in terms of the numbers of bears that we can support on some units is the amount of depredation. So what this table shows is the depredation damage estimates by county. And so you can see San Pete, Carbon, Wasatch, and Utah counties are the ones that tend to get the most. The amount of damage is on the other side. This is typically, almost exclusively, bear damage on sheep, lambs. Bears do take cattle, calves sometimes, but not nearly as many. This is mostly sheep. Obviously, that's a concern for our livestock producers. One of our strategies when we have conflicts in terms of livestock damage is to allow our sportsmen to take those bears where we've got situations where we've got concerns about damage. And so this chart just shows the amount of sport harvest over time compared to the yellow, and the depredation mortality. This would be Wildlife Service's take. So these are the government trappers. If they go out and solve a problem and have to kill a bear, that's the red line. We try to maintain the Wildlife Service's take fairly steadily, and when we have problems, we like to allow sportsmen to take those. And you can see over time that's been the case, that sportsmen have gotten the ability to harvest those bears when we have conflicts. Wildlife Services has stayed fairly consistent over time. So on to recommendations. First thing that we're going to recommend tonight is that we get back to what the plan says and go back to a three-year recommendation cycle. So the recommendations you see tonight will be in place beginning next year and run through 2021. We wouldn't make any adjustments to the recommendations tonight until then. And then as per the plan, we would evaluate based on the data and recommend changes depending on what we see over this three-year cycle. We are proposing, though, that there's a safety valve in this, and that is if we see any kind of biological emergency, a drought-related reduction in numbers, for example, we would bring that before the board. We've done this with turkeys. Turkeys are on a three-year guidebook. And if there's an emergency, we can bring that before the board to make adjustments. We also have the ability for the director to do emergency closures. And so there is a safety valve here. If we do see these things, we'll be evaluating as we go. One thing that we looked at over the last several years is the demand for bear permits. And so what you'll see here are, this is for residents. The yellow, I can't tell if that's yellow or orange, so sorry if I keep switching, but the orange line at the bottom are the number of permits that have been available over time. And that looks fairly flat because of the scale difference. But if you look at the red line, those are the number of applications for bear permits over time. So as is typical for a lot of our hunts, demand is definitely increasing, and permit availability has been increasing, but not keeping up with demand. And this is what it looks like for non-residents, fairly similar. Fewer people, but the same kind of pattern. You see this diverging between number of permits available and then the demand for permits. And so one thing that we looked at and discussed in the group as a way to maybe address some of this is to offer these fall spot and stock opportunities for bears. This is similar to what we currently do on the LaSalles and the San Juan. They already have a spot and stock opportunity in the fall. They issue about 65 permits on each of those units. You'll see several units tonight where we're making a recommendation to offer some of these permits. It would run basically from the beginning of the any or the general muzzleloader deer season through the end of the any weapon deer season. So that time frame. I get the thought here is that if you're a big game hunter and you're interested in hunting bears at the same time, you could draw one of those permits and be hunting bears at the same time you're hunting some of these other species. There are elk hunts during that time frame as well. This would be, again, spot and stock only. No baits or dogs allowed. One thing we'd need to do in order to prevent an overlap between late bait hunting in November and these season structures is to not allow early baiting before that November bear season. They just go ahead and start hunting with bait on the first Saturday in November. The next year would be November 4th. And that's just so there aren't baits in the field while people are hunting spot and stock, and they couldn't hunt over baits. There couldn't be any legal baits. The other thing you'll notice here is I've got dates for all 3 years of a recommendation cycle. So this is what people will see in the guidebook. We're recommending some hunt season changes, and this is, again, this came out of the committee. We had some concerns about season dates on the book cliffs from Houndsman. And so what we're doing is we're eliminating the archery-only season that we've had on the book cliffs in the past, and instead opening the fall season the first Saturday in August and running it through the end of November with no dogs from the opening of the limited entry archery season through October 1st. So that gives people a chance to hunt in August for about 2 weeks or more than they have right now. The big concern on the book cliffs is we have a lot of conflict between archers and houndsmen, and so we want to avoid having those two groups in the field at the same time. But this does give a couple weeks of extra opportunity to people who want to hunt with dogs before those archery seasons open. And in your packets you have the hunt tables. This is really the only change that we're recommending to season dates. Everything else is pretty much the same as it's been all along. We are recommending that we change the season dates on the LaSalle and San Juan for their spot and stock seasons to mirror the spot and stock seasons we just talked about on the other units throughout the state. So getting into individual unit recommendations. For the northeastern region, what I've done is if it's in green, it's a change. If it's gray, there's no change overall. So on the book cliffs, Bitter Creek South, we're recommending an additional 9 permits. North Slope, Three Corners, West Daggett, we're offering an additional 2 quota spot and stock. I should have mentioned, we're trying 2 strategies with the spot and stock hunting. One is to offer just straight permits. You draw the permit, you can hunt that season. The other is to do a quota system. So anybody that wants to buy a permit can, but once they take the number of bears in the quota, that spot and stock season would close. We want to see which one of those 2 strategies works the best or see what kind of feedback we can get on that. So in this case, it'd be a quota spot and stock season in the fall. Same thing on the South Slope Bonanza Diamond Mountain. In the northern region, this is a little bit of a change too. The northern region had the bear units. They had multiple units within their bear units, and they were split into 2 hunting areas. What we're doing in the northern region is splitting those units up a little bit. On the Cache in Ogden, We're offering 9 total permits, 5 of which will be spot and stock permits in the fall. On the Camas North Slope Summit unit, we're offering 26 permits, 5 of which would be spot and stock. And then on the Chalk Creek East Canyon Morgan South Ridge, these are the private land units in the northern region. They're recommending going to a harvest objective structure and offering 6 quota on some of those hunts. There are other hunts that they'll have permits for, and you can see those in your hunt tables. If you can see how that breaks down if you're interested. This is a change. What it basically does, it takes the Chalk Creek unit out of that Camas North Slope Summit. That's how it's been in the past. This does affect a conservation permit. Currently, there's a conservation permit that includes the Chalk Creek Camas. So we'll see how the board wants to do that later. But just so you know. Central region, on Central Mountain Nebo, we're recommending an additional 20 spot and stock permits. On the Wasatch Mountains West Central, 2 permits. Southeastern region, Central Mountains Manti North, 20 spot and stock permits. Central Mountains Manti South, San Rafael North, 20 spot and stock permits. On the LaSalle's, no change on the LaSalle's. The 9 mile, 10 spot and stock quota. So again, this is the quota type of approach. And actually that final one, looks like this is an old presentation. So we're not recommending a hunt on the San Juan Montezuma Canyon. That isn't in your packet. In the southern region, 2 fewer permits on the beaver, 2 more on the Dutton, 3 more on the Panguitch, 1 more on the Paunsagon, 20 spot and stock permits on the Plateau Boulder Kaparowitz, and 2 more on the Plateau Fish Lake Thousand Lake unit. We're also recommending some rule changes. First of all, we're recommending that a landowner lessee or their designee may be issued a control permit in situations where they're experiencing chronic crop depredation. We have had situations in southeastern Utah where bears have gotten into melons or sunflowers. The change here is that it allows it used to just allow the landowner or an immediate family member to have those permits. This is making it more consistent with what we do for mountain lions. So a landowner could designate someone for those permits. They wouldn't be able to keep the animal. This is strictly for depredation, but it might allow a landowner a little bit of flexibility to handle their own problem when they're experiencing chronic crop damage. The second recommended change to the rule is that we add language to the hunting hours part of the rule to clarify what we mean by hunting. So it'll say hounds may not be rigged 1/2 hour after official sunset to 1/2 hour before official sunrise, except during the summer season when they're allowed to start hunting at 5 a.m. And rigging means is defined in the rule to have trained dogs placed outside of a box or kennel or crate being transported in or on a motorized vehicle for the purpose of locating or pursuing bears. And so on some units, we've got people that are essentially hunting all night. They've got their dogs out there. They're looking for tracks. And we've got some concerns about the intent of the rule is that people don't start hunting until those legal hunting hours. So that's the reason for this change. Finally, they just made some changes to the legal firearm and archery equipment with the big game rule that includes the air bows. We're just proposing that we make those changes in the bear rule to be consistent. And then there's some clarifying language on dog handlers and who can retrieve dogs that have separated from a pursuit. We've had a little bit of questions in the field about, you know, if a dog get separated during a pursuit, who can go collect those animals, and so we've tried to clarify that a little bit too. We've changed the language a little bit on pursuit and bait. The big change here is to add language to clarify that a person may not intentionally start rig dogs at a registered bait station, or take with dogs a bear lured to a bait station. The change here is intentionally. Sometimes you don't know there's a bait station there, and our officers would have to figure that out in the field. But we just want to make it clear that anybody who intentionally starts their dogs from a bait station is breaking the rules. And then finally, we have some language in the rule about where people can place baits. There used to be some language in there about that was a little bit vague about putting things anywhere that the division felt like it might cause a nuisance. In practice, we haven't ever employed that, and it was vague enough that we were a little bit nervous about how that could be applied. And so we've removed that language. So it's still 100 yards from water, a public road or designated trail, or a half a mile from any permanent dwelling or campground. That seems to be sufficient to keep bears out of trouble. We've modified the language to clarify who can check a bear. So when you bring your bear in and check it in at one of our offices, the rule used to say it had to be checked by either by a conservation officer or at a regional office. In practice, biologists do that quite often, but the rule said it didn't include them in the list. And so we just made that division representative instead of conservation officer. And finally, when people check in their bears, we're requiring the exact location of kill when bears are checked in, and we'll ask that when people bring them in. And that's it. Is that enough?
Thanks, Darren. All right, questions from Rack. Mike.
Got a question. On the depredating bears, you said that the person who shoots it can't keep the bear.
Right.
So can they keep the meat? Or what part of the bear can they keep and can't they keep?
There is a way that we could authorize a person to keep a bear in that situation. The language is in the rule. But the intent with those permits is to handle a problem. And so what we don't want to happen is to have landowners selling a hunting opportunity to somebody when they really should be trying to solve a problem. And so that allows us to... it gives us a little bit of flexibility, but we don't want to... This isn't an opportunity to hunt bears. This is an opportunity to solve a problem.
Yeah, no, I totally...
That makes sense, Mike?
Yeah, no, I totally understand. And I just think it would be... I like that you said it's flexible, because, like, I don't eat bears, but I know a lot of guys do. So if that animal is to go to waste, and it could be...
I think we'd always rather either donate the meat or give it to somebody rather than waste it, for sure, yeah. But some, like you said, in Alaska, people love black bear meat. Here, maybe not quite so much. So
yeah, I don't know. And then the other question I had was on that same: they can't accept monetary compensation, but they could accept other kind of compensation.
I mean, again, that's not the intent, but it does specifically say monetary. Yeah, and that's similar to what we have in the Cougar Rule as well.
Okay.
Danny.
Oh, I was just going to see who else had questions.
Oh, preponderance of the photographs were cinnamon-colored bears. So are the cinnamon bears better eating? I'm just curious.
That's right. Especially covered in chocolate.
Yeah. I got a question. Excuse me, I'm from Sanpete County.
Uh-huh.
And speaking with several
houndsmen today about rigging hounds. Most of them are concerned about the loss of scent after daylight.
Right.
They're used to rigging their hounds a half hour before daylight. And can you address that or explain to me?
They could still, you can still rig hounds during legal hunting hours. So from 1/2 hour before sunrise, and that's always been the intent and the rule. I think that, there was enough ambiguity in the rule that some people, and I don't think this is a general practice, but we do have some people that are essentially running all night. They've got dogs out. We get complaints from other users that their dog's barking up and down the roads all night. And that was never the intent of the rule. The intent, like any other hunting hour rule, is that you start hunting 1/2 hour before. And now during the summer season, we changed that a couple of years ago to allow them to start at 5 because they had concerns about that scent dissipating. So that's nearly an hour before sunrise. That's not changing. They'd still be able to start rigging at legal hunting hours, basically.
During the summer.
How that would be, yeah.
Okay. The other one is the increase of permits north of Fairview and south of Fairview. Can you explain to me, I'd like to take this back to them, what the impetus of that is?
Sure. Maybe I'll have the region speak to that. They'll know the details.
Rusty Robinson, biologist. I believe those two units, they both called for a slight increase, 20%, up to 20% increase. But then we did the fall spot and stock as well on those. And the big thing on those units is our nuisance to sport harvest ratio is extremely high. For every 10 bears we kill on the North Manti with a tag, we're killing 7 more for just nuisance bears, wildlife services. So there's a lot of bears being killed, and we'd rather have hunters kill those than wildlife services.
So as far as the nuisances with sheep, is that?
Sheep depredation, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So not nuisance, I guess, depredation.
That makes sense.
Be the right word, yeah.
Okay.
So
thanks.
That answered, that helped? Okay.
Ben, I got a question. I have a more of a background question.
Uh-huh.
I'm glad to see the division recommending the 3-year intervals on the bears. Can you maybe give me a little more background of why you're requiring it for bears and how bears differ from cougar in this regard?
I think the cougar plan is similar. And I'm not exactly... The thing that's happened over time is that, you know, we've made these 3-year recommendations, and then we get a year into it and someone has an issue and wants to change it. And sometimes that's us. Sometimes that's the division. And so I think in order to do this, we need to be disciplined. But for both of these large predatory species, really I think we need to be in a place where we're doing multi-year recommendations and then evaluating those based on 3 years of consistent data. So we're doing that for bears now, and that's certainly something we'll look at for lions later. Does that help answer the question?
Yeah, that's helpful.
You brought this up before.
Yeah, no, it's I'm glad to see it on the agenda. Thanks.
No question. On the spot and stock hunts, is it legal to harvest over a carcass? Is that considered?
Yeah, it'd be similar to the bait. So you'd have to comply, but people couldn't place a bait and harvest over. But if it was a carcass that occurred naturally in the landscape, then,
or during the hunting season,
right?
Okay.
Or a gut pile,
yeah
they'd be okay to do that.
Okay, thanks.
I think it was on the slide, but I don't think I mentioned, but on the LaSalle's in San Juan, where we currently have this hunt, success rates vary from 10 to 15%, so that, you know, that's about how many we'd expect to see. That's the type of success rate that's probably the high end of what we'd see on some of these other units with less bears, or the densities are lower.
I've got a couple questions. I think Brock got me straightened out on one, but I just want to make sure. If you could go back on your slide deck to your permit number recommendations, where you had the, the 43 permits and then the 30 quota. Does that mean there's 43 limited entry permits? and then it's a harvest objective hunt with a
30.
Quota of 30. Yeah.
Sorry, Ben, I should have explained that better. Usually what we do is, the reason I did this is because what we've done in the past is just gave a total and didn't show you which was which. And so sometimes, you know, a quota means once they take 30 bears, they'll shut down the hunt. And those are split between hunts. So in your hunt tables, you can see how those break out. If you look at the harvest objective table, you can see where those 9-mile quota permits are.
So does this 30 quota on the 9-mile, does that apply to those 43 permits?
No.
Okay, those are two separate things.
Right.
For their own hunt.
43 permits, and then there are 30. There's an additional quota of 30 during different times.
Go buy a tag over-the-counter harvest objective permit with a quota of 30.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Ben, really quick on that same topic, so I understand it. Does the 10 spot and stock come out of the 30 quota?
Yes, that's part of that. So during the fall, there will be a season, and they'll have a quota of 10 for that spot and stock season. The same season is, you know, the same, you know, beginning of the muzzleloader deer to the end of the any weapon deer. But instead of permits, they can buy a permit and go hunt. And if we kill but 10 bears, we'll shut down.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then just one more question. Go back to, you had a slide with a graph of applicants over time.
This is the resident one, Bill.
Yes, perfect.
Sorry, Ben.
It looks to me like we had a big jump in interest from 2014 to 2015, which is the year 2015 is when we made some big changes. We allowed rifles over bait. We increased a lot of harvest objective opportunity. And I'm sure there's some other changes. Those are two big ones that stick out in my mind. Do you have some context as to which of those or anything else is driving that interest?
I think the biggest change in 2015 was adding some spot and stock opportunity to the LaSalle. That was what made the permits really jump.
Right, but I'm not looking
how that relates to interest. Yeah, how that relates to interest.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think we've seen similar patterns across all of our hunts, though. That we just see increasing interest in hunting over time. We've had a growing bear population, and that could have something to do with it. People are coming and then telling their friends, "Hey, you know, it was really fun, and we saw a lot of bears."
Yeah, sure.
So it could be that too.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Any other questions, Brock?
So, Darren, on the quota, Sam and the anthro, and I think you've designed this so people out deer hunting have the opportunity maybe. There's large areas of the anthro where I don't have cell service. Are they going to be required to call in every day and see if the quota has been filled?
Yeah,
so they're going to have to drive out of the anthro to make a call and then drive back into their hunting camp?
It'll be like it is with lion. It's just harvest. Well, for quota, yeah, it's harvest objective. You'll have to report that. So, yeah.
Okay, if we have no other questions from the rack, we'll move to questions from the public.
Oh. Just one quick one. More humor. I know of two archery hunters 2 years ago that harvested an elk, you know, Nimrods, didn't know what they were doing, and were dragging a ham out and confronted a sow with a couple of cubs, and they were so freaked out that they dropped the ham. And then, you know, the sow moved right on in, you know, because they backed off and went, mine. Yeah. So would that be considered baiting?
Yes, we've had that happen. Yeah. Right.
It would be baiting.
I see what you're saying.
You're spreading the that's
why I'm not an officer, but yeah.
Very good. Sorry, that was funny. Mine.
All right, let's move on to questions from the public. Is there any questions from the public? Please step up to the microphone, state your name, and state your questions. And also, let me reiterate, this is a time for questions only. Comment period will be after questions.
All right, Matt Farnsworth, just a real quick question on the Bookcliff Bitter Creek unit. You eliminated the archery hunt. So were those tags dispersed across the others, or... Those seven part of the nine that you're increasing?
They were dispersed. So this is nine more than last year. But yeah, so those seven archery tags are part of that.
Any other questions? Chet.
Chet Young. I've just got a couple questions for you, Darren. Uh-huh. On the harvest objective, some of that is in the fall with hounds being allowed.
Right.
On some units that are primarily private land, but they're not huge sections of private land. There's a lot of little areas. Is there some concern about, there's going to be a lot of houndsmen that have permission on this piece of property, but not on this.
Right.
I just see it giving the black eye to the houndsmen. You know, they'll start out trying to do it right, maybe, and then you're going to have hounds running through there. Is there a concern with, because it's during some of the other hunts, I just don't see that being a good fit with hounds.
Are we talking about the northern region units? Or the,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, the biggest concern there is that with a permit system, you've got landowners that have problems with depredation, and they can't get a permit to hunt a bear. And unlike lions, chronic livestock depredation, you can't get an extra bear permit like you can with a lion. So this is an approach to try to address those concerns, and we rather than carving those units in a detailed way, we took the ones that were primarily private, but your concerns, I think, are valid. So people need to, you know, consider what they're doing. But again, these units in the northern region are primarily private. So if you don't have access, you're not going to be doing a lot of hunting up there.
Okay. Is there some consideration on maybe trying to put a safety net in if it goes really south this year?
Yeah, I mean, so when we go back to that 3-year, there's always those safety valves. And so, you know, if we have a train wreck, we'll bring something back to the board. But the region feels pretty confident that it'll work.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Jason Binder. I have a whole slug of questions, but I'm not going to ask them all.
All right.
Can you tell me how many tags we increased last year?
I can. I can look it up, Jason. Let me do that. You already know the answer?
No, I didn't look it up before I got here.
All right, I'll look it up.
I thought about it, but then I figured I'd let you have it.
That's fair, but I figured if you knew, you could save us some time. Let's see. There we go. I have a number in my head. I just want to verify it because my head doesn't work as good as it used to. So,
hundred and two,
right?
And how many tags increased this year?
145. And that includes, when we say tags, some of that's quota, so it breaks down. But the difference is, yeah.
Okay, and can you explain to me exactly what justifies the increase this year? Again, when we've had increases for the last 10 years consecutive, and we've not followed the bear plan in the past on the 3-year increments like we were supposed to. So now that we've increased tags for the last 10 years, now we want to increase again and then follow the plan? Can you explain to me why we're doing that?
The increases are based, so what we're doing is getting back on track with the plan this year. The increases are all based on the parameters that are set forth in the plan. So we make recommendations on a unit by unit basis, and then whatever the total increase or decrease is based on the sum of those recommendations. Most of about half of the increase this year is into those spot and stock opportunities, and the quotas for spot and stock. And then, yeah, it's just, you know, how many adult males did you see in the harvest and how many females? And if you're below objective on females and above objective on adult males, you'd recommend an increase. But it's just they're all based on the plan.
That would be my next question. We don't have that data. Where were we at on our harvest?
I can get that for you. Yeah. if you want to look at those numbers, sure.
Well, I just think it's something important that all these gentlemen making and ladies making a decision tonight ought to see where we're at. Are we 30%, 40%, 50% south?
Part of the rack packet that they get, it has all that
stuff. Okay. And how many bears were euthanized this year for starvation?
None that I'm aware of.
How about LaSalle, San Juan?
I don't know that they killed any that were starving. I not that I've been told about. So,
does anybody in the audience have any want to contribute, division members? All right. Well, I guess we can discuss that at a different meeting.
I just texted Dustin Mitchell, the biologist there, to see.
I heard it was pretty detrimental down there this last year from biologists and regional managers down there. But
yeah, they're in fact
lower tags. We stayed the same.
They according to the plan, they should have increased tags down there, but because of the lack of reproduction the last couple during that 3-year cycle. They're recommending that we remain the same. So,
okay. And my next question would be, since we do a mathematical analysis of how we come up with our population, if we're seeing units that aren't having any cubs, how does that balance out in the math? I mean, if you don't have any reproduction, but yet we're seeing the population is the same when we're harvesting bears,
right?
That to me, that doesn't balance out.
The reconstruction, the numbers we put up here, Jason, are just adults, right? So this is a minimum estimated adult population. So if you're not having cubs and recruiting those, you would start to see that you know the next year, the year after, and that might be some of this leveling that we're seeing over the last 3 years.
Okay, and what is the average age of bears being harvested?
I can look at the data. I don't know off the top of my head.
So if the average age happens to be 10 and your recruitment 10 years later.
Right. There's a lag effect. Right, for sure.
There's not a balance.
Right.
All right, thanks.
Thanks, Jason. Other questions from the public? Step up to the mic. State your name.
My name's Kelly Christensen. I have a question for you. I want to know what you consider hunting on bears.
What are we talking about, the hunting hours?
No, I'm talking about hunting. You kept defining it as hunting. What do you consider as hunting?
Right. It depends on how you're hunting. So are we talking about dogs? And
yeah.
So the intent and the rule is that if you've got a dog rigged and you're actively driving the roads trying to pick up a trail, that you're hunting.
You're not hunting until that dog's released. It's no different than spotting deer before deer season. Not one bit. It's not one different than spotting elk before the elk season. And every hunter does it.
Sir, this is a time for questions, not comments. If you have a comment, please.
I know, I'm just asking.
Until the comment period.
That's why we're defining.
To you, just right. Having a dog on the track.
Right. That's what we're saying. You have to be actively trying to find a bear track and get on it. That's what we're saying in the rule. That's what we're recommending.
Well, like I'm saying, that's what I was asking. You're saying, I don't understand your definition because you're saying trying to get on it. Well, you're not on it until you release the dog. That's what I'm trying to get. What is actually hunting? This definition still doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What we're saying is you can't have a rigged dog outside of legal hunting hours. That's what the rule says.
Well, is it any different than... I got a question then, is it any different if anybody's dogs can actually go up the road and bark? And so would that be considered?
What the rule says is you have to actively be pursuing a bear.
Well, see, you just went back in. You're actively pursuing. And pursuit doesn't start till it hits the ground.
Right.
That's why I don't understand what your definition of hunting is.
This is how we're defining it in the rule.
Okay.
That if you've got dogs rigged, and you're driving, looking for bears, you're hunting bears. That's what the rule says. That's what our recommendation is.
Okay. That's why I just wonder your definition.
Yep.
Okay. Other questions from the public? All right. Seeing none, let's move on to comments from the public. We've got a handful of comment cards here. J.
Jason's got a timer ready to go. Again, as a reminder, if you're representing yourself, you'll have 3 minutes. And if you're representing an organization, you'll have five. As I call your name, step up to the mic, state your name and who you're representing, and proceed with your comments. If you want to make a comment and haven't turned in a comment card yet, please go ahead and do so while others are making their comments. First comment card, Kelly Christensen.
On the same thing we were just talking about, I've been in this longer than half of these guys have been alive. I've seen it all. I've been through the work with some of the other biologists, Hal Black, Jordan Peterson, on their hunts and different things. And I'm not seeing, just like Jason stated, I'm not seeing how last year when we recommended, I did stand up and recommend not adding more tags last year, because we've seen the same thing happen over the last 50 years I've hunted with dogs. Because of what I've seen, we had a hard winter as far as no snow, no feed, no acorns. I don't know if the numbers are true, what I've heard, but over 90% of the sub-adult bears died in the den last year. So wouldn't that be, instead of raising permits, some of these areas that happened in, such as the LaSalle's and San Juan, do you ever look at dropping permits in that area? I mean, that only makes sense. You're losing all your sub-adult bears, and then you're killing all your mature bears, what you're saying. Something has to replace them bears. I don't understand. I'd like that explained to me, why them units didn't drop in permits instead of even staying the same.
So we would drop permits if on a given unit, and it depends on the strategy that we're using. So the LaSalle's, I think, is a liberal unit. So if we saw adult males in the harvest less than 25% and adult females in the harvest above 45%, we'd recommend a decrease in permits. There's also a modifier there. If we don't see reproduction for, we look at 3 years of reproduction. This is where we're going in and visiting dens and looking at cubs. If we don't see that reproduction, we can modify that recommendation and actually reduce even further. So if you go three times, you see one birth pulse, you'd remain steady. You go three times, you don't see any. You'd make the recommendation based on this, and then you'd modify it. And that's actually what they did down there this year. They're okay on their adult portion, but they didn't see the reproduction. So they should have increased, but they didn't because they didn't see that reproduction.
That doesn't make sense to me because you got your numbers there. Well, the reason them numbers go up because there was more tags and more hunters on the mountain. Well, that's going to keep your numbers up higher when you give more tags. I mean, you can add 100 more tags.
When people harvest
more, but there's less bears.
This is based on the assumption that the harvest reflects what's available in the population. And so if you've got a lot of adult males in the harvest in a given year, then you've got a lot of adult males. Now, if you're taking those and you're seeing a decline, you'd start to see these numbers come off. And again, the plan is written so that we're looking at this on a three-year cycle. So we make a recommendation. This is what we're recommending this year. We make a recommendation, and we let it run for 3 years. And then we don't change anything until that third year. And then we look at this again, and then we'd make recommendations based on that. But this should capture some of those changes in population densities. And if we do see drought-related reduction in densities, it'll be captured, and eventually the recommendation would come down on permits.
Okay, another thing, I just short minute. I just want you to know that the way I feel with this rigging deal is going to cause more conflict on the mountain by far than letting it run like it is, because of the, you're going to concentrate everybody on every road. You're going to create havoc among the houndsmen. They're all going to race and park on a road and sleep on it. Now, we've had no problems. If a guy beats you there, he goes in front of you. You ride along behind him, bears cross behind him. We had no problems other than one person. in our whole area up here. What you're proposing this year, I think you're going to see some terribly drastic problems among houndsmen, among everybody. Because you're going to have, it's going to look like the 4th of July parade going up every road, because they're all going to be parked bumper to bumper and following everybody in. That way they were broke up a little. I don't agree with rigging all night either.
Sir, your comment time is up. Thank you for your comment. We appreciate it.
I wanted to let you know.
All right, next comment card, Colton Christensen.
I just want to thank everybody for taking time out of their night to meet with everyone and listen thoroughly. And I just want to state, first of all, I represent myself. I don't understand the drastic increase in proposed tags due to last year, two, three, five, depending on your idea of drought, increase on bear tags, and the fires we've had this year. I don't understand why we're going to increase and try and knock our numbers down more and more and more. And 100, I don't remember the exact numbers that Jason asked, 100-something tags proposed last year, and now another 100-something tags proposed this year. But on the chart, it seemed to be consecutively between 40 to 50% in the last, I believe, 5 to 10 years. So are the bears maintaining themselves, and we're adding tags for... What's the purpose in adding tags? I don't understand why we're wanting to kill more bears if, in the stats, it's showing that these bears are 40 to 50% harvested. Doesn't make sense to me. Is it about money? Is it more tags, more money? More opportunity for hunters to hunt bears? I don't understand the increase. And as far as the rigging goes, I represent myself. I believe most houndsmen agree. My dad said this. I do believe this rule before was kind of perceived. It was a gray area. I do agree to that. But now, if this goes into effect, I do believe the dust, the traffic, the havoc, the noise is going to increase tenfold. Your complaints are going to increase tenfold by campers, outdoor enthusiasts, hunters. I don't know why this has changed. We're going to change, but something to consider, I guess, in everybody's evening. I don't know if you've been on LaSalle, San Juan, these popular bear units in the spring, seen the numbers of hunters. If you haven't, I would recommend it. And I would recommend getting up at 6 a.m. one morning just to see the parade of houndsmen that you're proposing.
30 seconds.
Thank you.
Sir, I wasn't trying to cut you off. I was just letting you know you had 30 seconds left. Okay. Thank you. Next up, Chelsea Montague. And just for clarification, I will give you a 30-second warning if you're hitting that, so just so you know, your time's coming up.
Okay, I just want to say thank you guys for listening to us. So I'm also talking about the rigging and such. So I have rhetorical questions, so they're open-ended. I don't need an answer. So I can't have dogs placed outside of the box, but they're okay. But am I okay to rig bears from inside of the box, or can I just have any dog? Or I just can't have any dogs trained to pursue on the road at all until 6:30 a.m. So what if I'm traveling the roads with my dogs in the box to get to a certain mountain range before the official rigging time, and my dogs rig a bear on the way there? Does that mean I am non-compliant with the law? Also, how do these rules apply to people hunting off of horses who don't have a box? Am I not allowed to leave my home or camp until 6:30 a.m. to travel to my designated my desired hunting designation due to the fact that my dogs will most likely rig on the way there? Where do we draw the line with traveling and rigging? Why would rigging a bear before daylight cause any type of harm to anyone, as long as the dog doesn't pursue, hunt, or harvest a bear before legal hours? If this new proposal is of rigging at official hunting hours goes into effect, are you going to reconsider every start time for all hunters and huntresses? For example, archery hunters who walk to their tree stands before daylight, or any other big game hunter who hikes the mountains early in the morning to be able to get to their scouted spot before daylight. Waterfowl hunters that launch their duck boats and set up decoys before legal shooting times. If anyone's been to Farmington Bay the night before the opener, you can see that people are camped in their boats at their favorite hunting spot to save, you know, their spot that they love to hunt. Also, backpackers who might be backpacking into their desired areas days before their actual hunt. Are you going to restrict every single outdoor enthusiast, also your own activities and start times, due to the fact that it looks like us houndsmen are intending to hunt before legal hunting hours? Also, I think this will cause congested areas. I can only imagine every houndsman up the canyon, bumper to bumper, waiting to rig. It may not seem like a big deal, but if you have 10
seconds.
If you have 10 trucks and each of those trucks have 10 dogs, that's 100 dogs in one area. That seems more chaotic to me than just letting us single file. Also, I'm concerned with the new proposal that the congestion of houndsmen parading around could potentially cause the delay for emergency personnel to react to an emergency situation and or other hunters. You know, we're not the only ones on the mountains. We want to share the mountains with everyone, and, you know, it's hard to do so with the new rules.
Time.
Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. Next up, Matt Farnsworth.
Hello, gentlemen. I'm Matt Farnsworth. I'm representing the Houndsman Association today. Again, I like going somewhere in the middle of the pack. A lot of you guys have stole some of my thunder already, so I appreciate that. A couple things I want to talk about. The Utah Houndsman Association supports the proposal presented by the DWR, except for two items. One being the increase of tags on the Book Cliffs unit. The archery hunt that they eliminated statistically, historically, had a 0% success. So by moving those tags over to the other hunts, you've already increased the permits by 7 tags. With the 9 tag increase, you're increasing a total of 16 tags, which falls with outside the plan. We decided as a group that we want to put our money where our mouth is. Do you feel that those 9 tags are something that needs to happen, or you're concerned about eliminating them from any other sportsman group? Take them from us. Take them out of the spring pursuit season. That's how strongly we feel about it. We don't want to restrict other people's ability or their ability to hunt. So take it from us. Let us put our money where our mouth is. Secondly, we do not support the rigging rule. You've heard a lot of great examples that are a lot better than anything that I have on my paper here today. I'll just leave you with my personal spin on things. Some of you on the board know that I'm a police officer. If I am charged with any wildlife crime, I lose my job. My kids lose their house. That's just a fact. I hunt off a four-wheeler, ATV, 100% of the time. I don't have a box. I rig my dogs off my four-wheeler from the time I leave my house to from the time I leave my camp until the time I get back. This rule, if I have a dog that stays out after dark and I have to go and collect him, I'm in violation of this rule. If I'm charged with it, I lose my job. It doesn't seem like a fair outcome. We already have a rule that says we can't speed, so do we really need a rule that says we can't speed after dark as well? Okay. We can't pursue bears before the legal time limit. That's well established. We already have that law in the books when the Houndsman Association supports that 100%. The rigging law takes that just a little bit farther than the spirit of the law intends. Do any of you guys have any questions for me? Okay. I believe you all received a copy of the email. And if you have any clarification on that, please don't hesitate to contact any of us.
Thank you, Matt. Next up, Colton Belliston.
Okay. Some of my concerns is about...
State your name, please.
Colton Belliston. Some of my concerns are on the graph that he was showing
of harvest numbers. In 2014, we had a harvest success of 50%. Just 4 years later, as of last year, 2018, it dropped to 41%, 9% drop. Why is that? Is that drop? Is that because people just aren't being as successful, or is that because the bears aren't really there to begin with? I tend to think that it's because the bears aren't, you know, there to begin with. You know, bear hunting with hounds is a fairly successful thing to do. So how does that, in those 4 years, how does that drop, you know, 9%, yet we just keep on raising tags constantly every year? It's just more and more tags. Are we just raising tags because there's more interest in people wanting to hunt bear? Are we raising tags because the bears are actually there? Also, we're raising tags again after drastic droughts. We've had, you know, it's no secret, we've had bad droughts this year. We've had fires. There's been lots of concerns, you know, with cub survival rates. And it's pretty well-known fact, too, that with very dry seasons, the bears don't have the vegetation that they need to be able to even cycle properly to reproduce, you know, like they normally did on dry years. They don't reproduce like they, you know, do when they have the forage that they need. When it comes to the rigging, you know, hours, what are we really trying to accomplish on that, and how are we actually going to effectively be able to, I guess you could say, charge somebody for doing that? There's so much gray area left with that intent that really you would have a very hard time, probably in a lot of cases, being able to even prosecute it. Like they're saying, you can rig from having your dogs inside the box. You get pulled over just driving up the road, your dogs are barking. I mean, intent, painting the picture of that intent is
30 seconds.
There's way too much gray area there that is left up to too much interpretation, I feel like. Also, confrontation with, right now there's a lot of hunters out. People are spread all over the mountain, and we're going to congest everybody. You're going to cause more problems between houndsmen. You're going to bring more attention to us and probably get just as many complaints. Thanks.
Thank you for your comments. Next up, Chet Young. Following him will be Jason Binder, and that is the last comment card that I have.
Just several comments. The rigging law, I think most of that comes from down on the southern part of the state, LaSalle, San Juan. I know all houndsmen aren't perfect or whatever. I can tell you I've spent 60 days down there the last couple of years. I've never had a run-in with an officer. I've never had a run-in with another houndsman. If there's a few guys out there that's pushing these rigging laws to be reworded and changed, give them the ticket. Throw the book at them. But let's not change the wording so it affects every one of us that's out trying to gather up a dog and trying to do the right thing. Second thing is, on the book cliffs, it's an increase of 9 tags this year, plus 7 tags that are coming from the late archery season, which has been a 0% success rate. So that actually is an increase of 16 tags. I would like to ask that somehow that be brought down to 9 tags, just to kind of fit the plan. Because if you have a 0% success rate on a hunt for a couple of years, them tags shouldn't be in the pool. And the last thing is, any harvest objective with hounds, I'm strongly against. I think it'll give houndsmen a black eye, especially where it's in the fall in the northern part of the state. There's only a handful of tags across the state, so there will be a lot of houndsmen wanting that tag, wanting to be able to go hunting. So it'll congest everybody that doesn't have a tag for the fall up in that area, and I think it'll be bad for the houndsmen. I think it'll be bad for the private property owners. I think it'll be bad for the public in general. Thanks for your time.
Thanks, Chet. Jason Binder.
My name is Jason Binder. I'm not even going to touch the Regan rule, because on the way we're going, they're not going to be a bear left the rig. We increased tags the last 10 years. We should have been following the plan since 2011, 2012, with the stabilization of tags. We haven't seen that yet, and here we are again. Last year, we raised 102 tags. This year, we're raising another 145 tags, so that's 247 tags. 15 years ago, we only give out 300 tags. So now we're pushing the numbers of 1,000 bear tags. Why? The bear population hasn't changed. Just because there's more people putting in for bear tags doesn't mean the population can sustain the type of hunting opportunities that we want to put out. I mean, you're talking about an animal that sleeps 6 to 7 months out of the year and is not hurting our ecosystem. Yeah, they do get a few sheep, and they're either killed for being the offending animal, or the rancher is paid their money. I can't see why we have to keep increasing tags every year. To do the right thing on this plan, we should back up 3 years and go with those tag numbers and let that roll for 3 years and see exactly where we're at on a bear population. We have no clue where the bear population is. It's a mathematical number. Over the years where we don't have any cub recruitment, where are we going to be in 10 years from now? If everybody's killing 10, 12-year-old bears because they want a trophy, a 3-year-old bear is not a trophy. That's like shooting a doe deer and mounting it and putting it on your wall. This needs to be a quality hunt and a quality animal, and we need a sustainable population in Utah. Thank you.
Thanks, Jason. All right, that's the last comment card that I have, so let's bring it back to the rack for discussion. I took a few notes as we went through the public comments, wrote down a few things that came up. The rigging rule, the book cliffs tag increase, opposition to that, general opposition to tag increase in general, and opposition to harvest objective with hounds. I'll open it up to the RAC members for discussion. Let's go from there. Brock.
So, Darren, could you come and explain the reasoning behind the new rigging rule? I mean, I really appreciate all the comments from the public, and I'm a real fan of public input.
Right.
And so I'm trying to understand the conflict here.
Set this down, Brock.
Yeah, and On that note, I apologize. Again, from the RAC, thank you for the public comment. We do hear your comments, and we take them into consideration and definitely weigh them in our decision. Just as note, obviously decisions don't always go somebody's way. That doesn't mean that we didn't hear you. We definitely heard every comment, so thank you for that, and thank you for being here.
Maybe the easiest place to start is to actually read the definition that's in the rule on rigging.
I did read that today, but I'm trying to understand why everybody's in opposition.
Here's the intent. The intent. There's always been a limitation to hunting hours, right? That hasn't changed. We've had some problems in the field, and in some units more than others. You know, those units where we have a lot of interest. With enforcing those rules, and we wanted to try and clarify what we meant by hunting. And so this is what the definition. So we're saying you can't rig a dog, and what does that mean? So in the rule it says, rigged for the purposes of this rule means the act of having dogs trained in pursuit placed outside of a dog box, kennel, crate, or similar enclosure while being transported on a motorized vehicle for the purpose of locating and pursuing bear. So if they're outside of a box for the purpose of pursuing and locating a bear, we're defining that as you're hunting bears, and you can't do that outside of the legal hunting hours. If you've got a dog on a four-wheeler and you're running back to camp, that's not for the purpose of hunting or pursuing bears. That's not included in this definition of rigging. If you're transporting dogs to a hunting site, but you're not pursuing or hunting bears, you're not rigging for bears. So you have to be actively locating or pursuing a bear in order to meet this definition. That puts the burden on the division. We have to prove your intent. We have to do that anyway. This is an attempt to clarify what we mean and what we expect and the things that we're going to look at when we're trying to make those cases. So I hope that clarifies our intent. And
how has it changed from the old rule?
In the old rule, we didn't define rigging. We didn't. It just said you couldn't hunt or pursue bears from 1/2 hour before sunrise to 1/2 hour or after 1/2 hour after sunset. And so this is an attempt to clarify what we mean. So, yeah, the old rule didn't have a definition.
The public comment period is over. This is time for discussion amongst the URAC and with anybody that we call to discuss with. So, Darren, you are looking that up, correct?
Yeah.
I actually would like to know what the old rule states as well.
Sorry.
Can I make a comment while he's
yes.
looking? Then go ahead and interrupt me. As I read this rule that you just read, to me this puts the law officers in a pretty bad situation out in the mountains, because they have to make some decisions out there they really shouldn't have to make, in my opinion. And this is just my opinion. As I look at this, it says having dogs trained in pursuit. How do you tell if your dogs are rigged, if they're actually trained in pursuit, or if you're hauling them on an ATV or a four-wheeler outside of a box, or if you're on horseback? That right there puts that law officer in a no-win position. It would be difficult for him to make that determination out there. I just see this. I think about hunting elk. And if you're cow calling an elk long before the start of the hunt or half hour before, are you hunting that elk? Probably so, but it'd be tough to call, in my opinion. I just think it puts these law officers in a bad position. And frankly, I'm not a bear hunter, but I see this rigging rule as a problem.
This was an attempt by our law enforcement to try and clarify, you know, what we meant. But here's what the rule used to say. Here's what it said. Bear may not be taken or pursued only between 1/2 hour before official sunrise through 1/2 hour after sunset, except during the summer seasons when that begins at 5 a.m. That's what it used to say. And what we're doing, what we've added is a sentence that says dogs may not be rigged from 1/2 hour after sunset to 1/2 hour before sunrise. So we're just saying you can't, as I defined rigging. So that's what we're proposing tonight.
So I think the way I interpret this, what the DWR is trying to do is add some teeth to that to where they can actually say this person is hunting outside of hunting hours and this is why. This is a tough one because I think there was a lot of good. I think the intent is pure, and I think the Houndsman Association would agree with that. As I've talked to Aaron about this issue, but maybe you could talk a little bit more. As I've talked through this with Aaron, and as has been brought up to me, the concern is. Somebody who picks up their dog and is on their way back to camp after dark, they're not hunting anymore, but they're like the gentleman that hunts on a four-wheeler, doesn't have a box. They've only got one way to haul their dog, and that's technically in a rigging position. I don't want to penalize that guy.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Right. I think
that's where it becomes difficult.
I think the escape on that is for the purposes of locating or pursuing bear.
And so how does... So how does law enforcement interpret that? Because that it almost becomes like, is it even enforceable with that language?
Yeah. I think what we're trying to do is be more specific about what we mean when we say hunting, and this was our recommendation to try to clarify that. If we don't add that and we just leave it as is, it doesn't really change a lot. They're still going to have to prove that someone had a dog that was trained in pursuit and that they're attempting to locate or pursue a bear.
And helps, man. The other thing that I personally don't like about it is we've already have a rule that says it's illegal to hunt outside of hunting hours. And I hate regulation on top of regulation to enforce the regulation that's already there. That's my opinion. A little bit. Ken, you've got a comment. Go ahead.
Well, I just want to hear again from this gentleman that's the police officer on how he does his hounds again and how it could affect his job. I wish he'd come back up and explain that again.
So, I'm governed by two separate bodies, Utah Post, police officer.
Can you state your name real quick?
Yeah. Matt Farnsworth.
Thank you.
Governed by two separate bodies. Post, Police Officer Standard and Training, and BCI, the Bureau of Criminal Investigation. If I am charged with any wildlife violation, I lose my clearance through BCI. I cannot do my job. Any wildlife violation automatically is sent to Post for review. At a minimum, I will be suspended for a period of 1 year from my employment, at a minimum, if I'm found guilty of that charge. The BCI stuff, I lose instantly if upon being charged. And the post at a minimum of 1 year if I'm successfully convicted. Does that answer your question a little bit?
Well, but you talked about your transportation too. Explain that one more time.
So again, I hunt off an ATV 100% of the time. Nebo unit is the majority of my hunting. I live at the base of it. I go out in the morning. I unkennel my dogs. I put collars on them. I put two on the front rack, two on the back rack, and I drive up the canyon. From my house, it might take me an hour to get to where I prefer to hunt. Yeah, there's a possibility of me hitting a bear track on the way, you know, sooner than that hour. But that's how I transfer my dogs to and from every day, is exactly in that rigging position as stated by the law.
Thank you. Thanks.
Mr. Farnsworth, before you walk away, so because you're an officer, you're confronted with the whole issue of, you know, can you actually, is it enforceable? Do you think that rigging rule, in your mind, and you deal with a lot of stuff where you've got to make these kinds of decisions virtually daily, hourly even. Can I bust that person?
So let me say this. I support the wildlife section, and especially the enforcement section, 110%. I would be all for giving them any tool that they could use. As I mentioned in my presentation, we already have a law that says we can't speed. We have a law that says we can't hunt bears in that half hour before official sunrise. Do we need one that says we can't speed before dark? I don't think we do. I definitely see some legal challenges, but that's my perspective only.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Do we have DWR law enforcement representation here tonight? would you mind? I'd like to hear from your perspective how you would enforce this with the old rule or the new rule.
It may not be the best law enforcement.
Sergeant Ray Loken, law enforcement with the Division of Wildlife. However, my area of responsibility is Salt Lake and Tooele counties, and we don't hunt bears there. And I've been there a long time, so I don't have to deal with this. So I really am not the best guy to ask. I wish we had someone from San Juan County or wherever it is they hunt bears. But I do see there's challenges with it.
Can I ask maybe one question?
Go ahead.
So the old rule said taken or pursued. So in the example where somebody's running up the canyon, the old rule, they would technically have to wait until 30 minutes prior to sunrise to actually get off the four-wheeler and
yeah, to actually set the dogs out and let them go.
Right.
Now you'd have to wait till the time period So I can see the problem. I assume just from listening what we're talking about here, it's basically somebody might be driving up the road at 4 in the morning to go to where they're going, and the dogs start barking. They know that they've cut a track, so they're going to stop and wait till the proper time and then let the dogs out. But some people, I guess, maybe not waiting the proper amount of time. So,
and from that perspective, I mean, I don't know that that's... Well, I don't know if they are, Brock, because how is that different from...
If they let their dogs out, they will.
Right. If they let their dogs out, yes. But as, say, an elk hunter driving down the road on my four, and I hear a bugle an hour or two before daylight, and I stop because there's an elk there, so I'm going to go wait till light and go hunt.
That's an assumption. I was bugling. Yeah, I was practicing, yeah.
Sure, but, you know, it's... I'm struggling with this one. I get the intent and I like the intent, but it feels like there's a lot of ways to make criminals of good people here. It also feels redundant.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Ben. And what keeps popping into my mind is I've never been to the Pontsagant, but I've had a lot of people tell me it's pretty bright at night out in the desert where people are spotlighting all night long looking for bucks to go back and try to shoot the next morning. And it just,
it's true.
It feels like it's... It feels like it's a noble idea, but maybe it has some unforeseen issues with it.
I've got just one more comment on that, too, and I agree. I spoke with 5 different houndsmen, and every one of them said basically the same thing. If our dogs, if they're driving up the road and all of a sudden their dogs start barking and it's 1 or 2 hours before, they wait. And quite frankly, I think probably 99% of the houndsmen do that. And I would recommend that we prosecute the SOBs that don't and leave the good people alone.
Well, at that, I'd like to make a proposal just on the rigging part, that we do not accept the division's proposal as presented.
Okay, we have a motion.
Second.
So motion by Ken, seconded by Steve. Let me restate the motion. The motion is to not approve the new rigging rule. Is that sufficient? All right. Yes, any discussion on the motion? Mike?
I agree with you. I just wonder, does this give direction to the board that they'll understand what we mean by this, just to revert to the old language? Is that what we're...
I like prosecute the SOBs. that in there.
All right. Carl, is this sufficient for the board? Okay. All right. Any other discussion?
So I'd just like to make a comment that this is because of the public input. There's nobody in here talking the other side from the public. There's only one side being represented here. And I recall back to the new muzzleloader hunts. The public came in and said no, and we voted against it at the late season. And so.
Yep. All right. Any other discussion? Seeing none, I will call for a vote. All in favor? Passes unanimous. Okay, we still have more to discuss. If we want to take these on, does anybody have any particular item they want to discuss?
Really quick, I'd like what Chet said about there's a quota of 3. A harvest objective quota of 3 tags in the new unit that you've created with the private lands, and since it is a new unit that contains a lot of that overlaps a lot of big game hunting seasons, I can see that. I can see what Chet's saying as that is an issue. I know a lot of landowners up in that area that wouldn't appreciate a pack of hounds running through there. Their paid clients deer hunt. And so I'd probably recommend that we move that quota of 3 from the fall season to the to the spring season, have a quota of six. It would be something that I would like to look into. I don't know what the RAC's feelings are on that.
I'm sorry, are you looking for discussion on that, or was that a motion?
I'm just looking for discussion. I mean, I don't mind hearing other people's opinions before we vote. I think it's good to bounce things around, and maybe something's thought of that I'm not thinking of, but...
I'm not informed enough. Aaron, I'm sure you worked this out with the regional biologist, right? And they think this is a good idea?
Right, and this came at the request of landowners in on this unit, that they wanted the tools to be able to handle their own problems. And so there are a lot of different options we talked about, but this was the easiest with our current system, just to allow a harvest objective strategy. So if they've got bears that are causing problems with their livestock, they can go buy a permit, or they can get somebody that they know to go buy a permit over the counter and come and handle that problem. And I think if we take those out of the fall, we'd be eliminating a fall hunt. They wouldn't be able to do anything during that time frame. So we tried to limit to those units that are primarily private, and that's really the bottleneck is access on those units. But those are some of the discussions, Mike.
And so that idea did come from landowners in that area.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
Darren, I would like to, not a question, I'd just like to compliment the division on the whole, bear regulations, as I was telling Christine, for our almost 100-year-old nonprofit foundation now, have always been the most controversial, and we'll see that again tonight. Almost split right down the middle, but most of the issues were between what we call baiting versus fair chase. And so I just want to compliment the division for offering an increased number of what we would call fair chase type opportunities in the field, because really for most of us, it's not about killing something. Other than me, I like to kill everything, but seriously, truly, I think the biggest value for the public is just getting out in the field, and I just want to compliment you guys for giving us that opportunity or that reason to maybe leave the house.
Are we ready to move on?
Yeah, I think so.
Sorry. Darren, I'm going to ask you to come back up again. So there's been a lot of comment about increasing tags. I just want to reiterate, all the recommendations are based on the management plan.
Right.
So if we're harvesting too many old animals or not enough females, you recommend an increase. I do understand the concerns about maybe the LaSalles and the Bookcliffs. I just talked to Dustin, and he said that there were no cubs this year, zero, and that they had 20% yearling survival. But there were no bears euthanized for starvation. Six bears were euthanized in the whole region, none for starvation. One was in poor shape of the six that they euthanized.
Right under the plan, based on these parameters, we would have been recommending an increase in permits, but because of those reasons, we're not recommending a change on those units.
Darren, really quick. My math, quick math in my head, showed like around 200, 215 spot and stock permits. And off of those, you're thinking that there would be a success rate of around 10 to 15%?
Right.
In the
On dense bear units. Yeah. So if you have less density of bears, it'd probably be less.
Yeah. So while it looks like we've ballooned permits,
right, that masks that a little bit.
A lot of that increase has been gone or goes to spot and stock.
Yeah. So out of the 145 increase, and that includes quota, about half of that is in these spot and stock opportunities with low success rate. So a
lot more tags,
yeah.
Not much impact.
And that's kind of my point is we've heard that there's been this big increase over the last few years, but a lot of that increase is coming off of the backs of non-houndsmen who are going to have a 10% success rate.
Right. It's an opportunity hunt. And, you know, a lot of our neighboring states, that's how they hunt bears, is spot and stalk primarily, and those success rates are fairly low.
Darren, don't go too far. I'd like to address the Houndsman Association concern about the buck cliffs. They're looking for no increase there, and part of their reasoning is because of those 7 tags from the archery hunt that got eliminated. And I think it was stated that there was 0% success rate there, but I don't believe that's accurate. I think there was some harvest there. I know it's been a minimal success
rate. Right. I don't know off the top of my head, but it certainly wasn't 50. It was definitely lower.
Sure. Was that taken into consideration? Do you know the recommendation of the additional 9 on top of those?
I think what we did is we took the level of permits and made the recommendation based on that. So I think that's a fair critique that we are taking some permits out of a low success opportunity and putting them into a higher success opportunity. I think that's fair.
That was taken into consideration and accounted for.
No, I think we thought about that, but I think those impacts would be a little different than they would if they were just permits that were there in a normal opportunity.
Yeah.
I have one more question before you take off. As I've already stated, I'm glad to see the 3-year interval change. I think that is going to provide a lot more data and answer a lot of the questions that have been voiced in terms of actually counting the number of bears on the mountain. When you recommended the increase this year, would that recommendation look different? And maybe this is somewhat of a hypothetical question, but I'm sure you took into account this increase, given that it's technically not supposed to change for the next 3 years. If it was going to change, say, for 1 year again, would that have recommendation looked any different? Do you see the question?
I think based on what we've been doing over the last 3 or 4 years, we've been making recommendations yearly, and we're still basing it on the 3 year prior. I think it's fair to say we've been increasing faster than the plan spells out, and so really this is an opportunity, and we're making the recommendation now that we revisit the plan, and you know from this point moving forward, if we'd had a 3-year cycle, you know, 2 years ago, then the objective then would be to stick with what we had that year, but. That's kind of water under the bridge at this point. Again, those recommendations are still based on the plan and made based on 3 years of data. So, yeah.
All right, thanks.
I don't know if that helps.
Mike, you look like you've got something.
Yeah, so based on what Darren said there about the book cliffs, I'd make the motion that we reduce the division's recommendation of 9 increase of 9 permits to an increase of 2 permits, which takes into account the 7 archery permits. So there's essentially,
Is that a motion?
Yes.
Okay. So we have a motion to reduce the increase on the book cliffs from 9 to 2. Is there a second?
A second, that.
Okay, so we have a motion from Mike to reduce. Sorry, I'm trying to take some notes here. Reduce the book cliffs increase from 9 to 2, and a second by Josh. Discussion from the rack. That's correct.
So, I mean, Ben, I wish I knew, or if somebody knew what the harvest success rate was on the archery so that we were increasing by 9 tags. So if they're having a 20% increase, maybe we're increased by 3 or 4 instead of by 9.
Darren, would you be able to look that up?
Yeah, okay. I understand what you're saying, bro. That makes sense.
Okay, while Darren's looking that up, I would like to add to that. I called Dax Mangus this evening on my way here to ask about this specific issue on the book cliffs. For those that don't know, he's the regional wildlife supervisor, correct, in the northeastern region. The feedback that he gave me on this is the reason they're looking for a tag increase out there
One, it falls within the plan. The plan supports it. But also, they've got some real deer, adult deer survival issues out on that unit that are, he believes, are not entirely related, but somewhat related to predation, bear predation. And it was an interesting conversation. One of the things that he doesn't know for sure, they're going to be doing some studies starting next year, a lot of collar studies out there.
Starting
tomorrow. Maybe Brock can fill in where I miss. Sounds like he's well informed. There was a study done in Colorado that's a very similar unit to the Book Cliffs, where they found that the bears in high density bear areas, bears were taking over lion kills and pushing the lions off. So the bears may not actually be killing the animals, but they're taking over the kills and thus increasing the lion take. So anyway. Long story short, he said the reason for the increase was to address some of these, the low adult survival rate on deer. He also mentioned elk. They're having some issues with out there also. So,
to give you a little perspective, average adult survival for deer in the entire state is 86%, and on the Book Cliffs this year it's 64%.
Well, and that's great information. Is that supported by...
Yeah, actually, we're looking at the lion bear side of that as well. So we're actually actively capturing lions right now on the Book Cliffs. We've got bear on the air. When we detect a kill by a lion, we're going to put a camera on that kill site and see what happens. Yeah. And so we're doing that on the Book Cliffs, on the Manti, and on the cache as well. Caches are controlled. We don't have as many bears. The success rate over the last couple of years on that hunt's been 17%. There's been 17 tags. That means they kill about one bear out of those tags.
Okay. So but really quick, does what Ben said support, is that supported by what you understand? Because that's not anything I heard in the presentation, that the reason for that increase is to address bear.
The reason they're increasing within the parameters of the plan, but they're being generous because they're trying to limit bear numbers and try to address some of those concerns.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that before I made my motion, but after hearing you say that, I withdraw my motion.
Okay.
And I just, information that I had got out of Dax early this evening, and I felt that it was relevant to the discussion. So
I agree 100%, and I think that should be expressed.
Okay, so the motion has been redacted, taken away. All right. Okay. I guess with that, let's move on. We have any other particular items that we would like to discuss, or if not, we can look for a motion to the balance.
I move to approve the balance of the recommendation.
Okay. Motion by Brock. Second by Ken. All right. So motion to approve the balance of the recommendations. Motion was by Brock, seconded by Ken. All in favor? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 in favor. Opposed? 3 opposed. So motion carries. And let me get you the names. So if you were in favor, please raise your hands again. So we had in favor Ken, Josh, Brock, Mike, and George. And for those that were opposed, would any of you like to give any context as to your opposition?
I don't mind. I still think that we don't really have a real strong handle on the permits themselves. And I think there's enough question and ambiguity in the results and the recommendation that, coming from San Pete County, I'm not exactly sure that that's exactly what I want to report to my houndsmen and the public down there.
Okay. And, I haven't heard, I've heard consistently from the public the same
the same doubts about the total numbers, and maybe not in specific areas, but just the total numbers. Although I did make the comment that fair chase is only going to accommodate, you know, is not going to increase harvest significantly. I think that this drought is and the fires have caused us some troubles that we really haven't seen the result of that yet. So that's my comment.
Okay. Christine, would you like to add anything? Okay. All right. With that, that wraps up the bear recommendations. We'll move on to the pronghorn unit plans. You don't look like Kent.
No, you get a less handsome version of Kent today.
All right.
Kent's busy on deer captures. It's a busy season for him, so we'd ask if you wouldn't mind excusing him and putting up with me tonight. We're going to move into something people are really passionate about now. So, you're ready to get going. We'll start with our pronghorn unit plans. Just by way of introduction, the statewide plan was presented and approved by the Wildlife Board in 2017. And just in accordance with that plan, these unit plans are following through with those now. By way of note, the unit plans will not be presented again to the RAC unless there are some significant changes. And some of those changes include the boundary change or change in population objective, or if a new unit is created. All other changes to the unit plans will be approved by the DWR director. From one of the major points of interest on the statewide plan is that all the units and subunits will manage for a 3-year average age of 2.5. So harvested animals age between 2 and a 3-year-old animal. And the use of archery and muzzleloader hunts to help distribute hunters and provide additional opportunities. On our population management goal, manage populations to their population objective in each one of the plans, looking at the carrying capacity and the available habitats for each unit, and also try to maintain a statewide population objective by just combination of all objectives together through all the plans. Here's a bit of what that looks like right now for our statewide objective and estimates. You can see that we are trending up. As far as population objectives go for the individual units, we'll look at those now. You can see we have a little bit of work to do in the central region. We do have some units that are difficult to get a population estimate on. Some of that has to do with the ability to classify in the desert or to fly and get any population census due to military airspace. But we are working hard to increase those numbers anyway. Here are some of the population objectives for the north, the eastern region. We'll move right along, look at the northern region. You can see that our populations were doing well. Pronghorn are becoming a desired species. They're desired heavily in other portions of the country and are becoming more sought after in Utah for sure. Our population objectives, you know, are doing well across the state. We're trying to look for areas to improve as we look at each individual unit. And the one thing on these unit plans that are mentioned heavily on each individual unit is the goal to get to our population objectives. And part of that has to do with the different tools that we have. Transplant sites or transplant of pronghorn is one tool that we have. On our individual unit management plans, we do recommend a few additional sites. The North Slope, we have Antelope Flat, Bear Top, Clay Basin, Connor Basin, Death Valley, and Goslin Mountain. And if these are approved by the Wildlife Board, they will be amended to the statewide transplant list. Again, part of the emphasis that we have in trying to reach our habitat or our population objective is our habitat. This is one of the limiting factors, one of the main limiting factors. And so this is a main point of emphasis. We're going to continue to work with water improvements. That is something that we are reaching towards. We have a goal of always in the central region. A lot of our pronghorn are out in the desert where they are water limited. And so we try to work towards that and to conduct projects that'll help support more pronghorn moving forward. One of the cool things that we have going on with our migration initiative is identifying migration routes for our pronghorn, and we continue to work towards that and to see if we can't remove any barriers that impede pronghorn. And to keep things simple, that is all we have with the unit pronghorn plans.
Thanks, Riley. Any questions from the RAC? Ken?
Yeah, I spent a lot of time this year down on the plateau. Where do you hide the antelope down there? Because I wasn't hunting them, just spending a lot of time down there, but I don't think I seen a group bigger than five, and I'll bet I didn't see a group bigger than three groups. And that's it. And yeah. We spent days down there.
Yeah, that one is a tough one to answer, and I've spent time down there as well. And what I would say to that is somehow the population moves and has the ability to hide, but when we do our population census and we take our harvest data back, we still have strong population numbers, and so that is an interesting one. I think historically they've been higher in the past, and so it gives the impression that maybe they are not doing well. But according to the population, our population objective, we still have a strong population there, and they are doing well. They're maybe a little tougher to find, but they're still doing well.
Sounds to me like they're taking notes from the Wasatch elk. Any other questions?
Yeah, what's your urban antelope plan?
Yeah. That's a good question. Sometimes with the urban pronghorn, they take care of themselves. We've had issues around Harriman. We have issues now with Saratoga Springs. The Harriman ones, they seem to take care of themselves except for just a few animals, and we did have to trap a few out or euthanize a few, and that's the same with Saratoga Springs. And we hope that as the building continues, because they do migrate a little bit south, that the building continues, they won't migrate back in. But if they do and they become trapped like the ones in Harriman, then we will address that at that time.
Do you look forward to like trying to transplant those or just euthanize?
We did. No, if we can trap them, we did move them out to, they are within the unit, and we'd move them farther out into a unit that hopefully they don't come back.
And then, I don't know that you can answer it specifically because you're not over it, but like the rich herd, the cash rich herd, I mean, it's population objective of 600. If I go into unit 100 in Wyoming, I can see 600 antelope and see the Utah border and from the same spot. I mean, do we count those antelope when they come into Utah, or how does that population?
So that one, like I said, I'm not over it. So yeah. To speak to that area specifically is tough. I know that in areas where we have migrating animals, period, we do the best that we can to estimate the number of animals that are there for the majority of the time. And our population objectives that we take into consideration is for the available space that we have within the current unit boundaries. And so I don't know if somebody wants to speak further to that, but I think we do the best that we can at making an objective that can be held within that area. And we understand that some of the animals are going to come, some of them are going to go, and we'll just move accordingly.
Danny?
Yeah, sorry. Justin, do you have something to add to that?
Oh.
Sir, we don't take, it's great. Not public question comment time yet.
Justin Shannon, Wildlife Secretary. To get at both of these questions, one thing we've done is put a lot more GPS collars out on Pronghorn. Last year we put 75 on the Parker Mountain because you bring up a good question. Where are they going? We'd like to understand that a little bit better as well. And I think as we put out more collars, we're gonna have a better understanding of do we have the appropriate boundaries for these things. So we've got a lot to learn.
Nice.
I talked to Jim Lamb just day before yesterday about that, and he said they've all moved into the trees. They live in the pockets within the trees. They aren't in the open like they were 10 years ago.
I went through the trees. I went through the Quakies, and I went through the pines.
Where the rabbit wouldn't go.
I covered that whole mountain from north to south, east and west.
Okay. And one more question, comment. You know, we do have a herd where we know where they are. They probably came off Antelope Island, right? But yesterday I was telling Christine, I saw 62 antelope in a herd right there, just west of the International Center. A great watchable wildlife. Oh my God, it was just awesome. No big bucks. But what's our thoughts there in terms of, are we just going to try to start transplanting those critters somewhere else because they really have nowhere else to go? We're going to put a prison in there. We're going to put an inland port in there. And, you know, I don't see the future. And we're putting in buildings out there like crazy. So I don't really see a bright future for antelope in that area, at least not in the numbers that we see now. So what's our plan?
So, I mean, that's not a problem that is new to this region and the animals that live in it. And the plan is to use every and any tool that we have. And sometimes translocating the animals makes sense. Sometimes giving additional hunting opportunity makes sense. Sometimes utilizing both or hazing or however we can address that, we're going to do. And so those specific animals moving forward, we're going to try and hunt them in a manner that's acceptable moving forward.
Maybe archery.
We're going to try to use every tool that we have in the box. And sometimes one doesn't work so well, so we have to move to the other. But that is a population that we are going to try and to be aggressive on hunting.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Riley, you said that antelope are becoming rather desired. The current present public might disagree. I don't know. Contradict that. But seeing no public, we'll just move to rack discussion and look for a motion if we're ready or when we're ready. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, without further discussion, I move to approve as presented.
Second.
Okay, we have a motion by Mike to approve as presented. Was he the second? Brock, second by Brock. Thank you. I wasn't going to ask for. So, yeah, any discussion? All right, seeing none, all in favor? Passes unanimous. Riley, I assume you're going to take the moose plans as well?
I am, yeah.
All right.
So the moose will very similar to the pronghorn. So we'll move right into it. Again, the statewide moose plan was presented in the fall of 2017 and approved by the Wildlife Board. And so, again, in accordance with the statewide plan, the unit plans are being brought forward at this time. And the unit plans stay within the sideboards of the statewide plan. And as with the pronghorn, the unit plans will not be presented again unless there is a major boundary change or population objective change or a new unit is being proposed. The 10 unit plans being discussed today, Box Elder, Cache, Ogden, Morgan, Southridge, East Canyon, Chalk Creek, Camas, North Slope, South Slope, and the Wasatch Mountain, Central Mountains. From the statewide plan, there was a large desire to increase hunting opportunity. Moose are a once-in-a-lifetime species. There is a lot of desire to be able to pursue the animals, and so there was a desire for an increased experience. And so we wanted that to increase the opportunity while maintaining quality. And that desire came out in an average age of a four-year-old animal. And so we want to manage for a three-year average age of harvested bulls from 3.75 to 4.25 on all units. And then we'll use the different subunits to maximize hunting opportunities and to equally distribute hunters as best as we can to provide a great hunting opportunity. Again, here are some population objectives and estimates. We do have moose transplant sites. Moose are get transplanted maybe in different ways than pronghorn would or other animals. And that we do have nuisance issues with moose. They come into areas, and they're a large animal, and they can cause a few problems. And so a lot of the moose do get transplanted because of nuisance issues. And we do, on this plan, propose a few additional transplant sites. And if approved, this will amend the table and be added to the statewide transplant list. And those are included in Camas, the North Slope and South Slope. Specific areas are listed there. Again, you know, as a point of emphasis on most unit plans for every animal, you know, if the habitat is not there, the animals aren't there. And so that is not any different for the moose. And where it is possible, the plans look at preserving and regenerating the habitat that is essential for moose to live and to thrive. And, you know, we will use all the tools possible, including the WRI process to improve habitat and you know, regenerate what has been lost. And again, keeping it simple, that is all we have on the moose plans. Thank you.
Thanks, Riley. Any questions from the rack?
Is box elder on the transplant list?
Right there, yes. That's already currently there.
Okay.
Other questions? All right, seeing none, discussion or emotion?
Move to approve as presented.
Okay, we have a motion to approve as presented by Brock, second by George. Any discussion on the motion? All in favor? Passes unanimous. Thank you, Riley. Next up, we have CH Rule Amendments, Avery Cook.
So I'm Avery Cook, the Upland Game Project Leader for the Utah Division of Wildlife. I'll be talking about commercial hunting areas and some proposed rule amendments regarding commercial hunting areas. So just a little bit of background on what CHAs are and why we're involved in them. So they're areas where people can release pen-reared game birds on private property for the purposes of hunting. So basically, they're the kind of commercial pheasant hunting areas, generally also chuckers and quail on those, where people will go pay for a hunt, usually pay by bird and pay a membership fee, have birds released for them, and go out hunt them. So these commercial hunting areas provide quite a bit of additional hunting opportunity in addition to what's available from our wild populations in the state. We have about 19,000 hunter days on commercial hunting areas, and there's currently 76 commercial hunting areas permitted in Utah. Even though they're basically private property pen-reared birds that are released on private property, they're regulated by the Division of Wildlife because they are game birds that also occur in naturalized or wild populations in the state. And the hunting on CHAs has significant chance of impacting wildlife on both disturbance of wintering and breeding birds, both the game birds specifically that people are hunting and just other non-game species on those properties or surrounding the areas. There's potential for disease transmission, especially between these captive flocks in high-density captive pens going into the wild and potentially spreading disease both to wild populations and to the commercial poultry industry. And then there's also a chance of lethal take of non-target species, so either sharptail, another grouse species that have hens that look pretty similar to hen pheasants that are permitted to be taken on commercial hunting areas. So we try and basically minimize those risks to our wild populations and disease transmission. Within Utah, CHA can release pheasants, checkers, or quail each year. These stats are from just from the last season, but about 90,000 pheasants, 16,000 checkers, and 2,000 quail each year are released for hunting on the CHAs. So the changes that we're proposing today are primarily to streamline the permitting process, both to make it easier on the permittees running the CHAs and also reduce some administrative burden on the Division of Wildlife. So some of these rule changes are designed at reducing redundant applications, allowing digital mapping, simplifying reporting, updating boundary requirements, clarifying some rule language, and also updating disease requirements. So the first change, we're looking at updating the map requirements. Currently, we're requiring paper plat maps and USGS paper topo maps. We'd like to allow digital mapping so we can have either people draw the polygons on a website or send us a digital file. Is a kind of a simpler alternative to having to get those county plat maps and get topo maps, which are less and less available. And we're also looking to require boundary verification for renewal applications. Under the current rule, we don't require a map or a boundary verification when they're sitting in a renewal application, but we've got over the stretch of 10, 20, 30 years, some of these CHAs are operating, and the boundaries do drift relative to that original application. So we're just looking to verify the boundary with each renewal application. We're looking to also update our acreage requirements. Currently, it's limited to 3 sections per CHA, or 1,920 acres. We're looking at raising that to 5,760 acres, or 9 square miles, or 9 sections. The reasoning behind that is, as it stands, a single operator, if they go over that acreage cap, they simply can turn in a second application or a third application. We're looking at changing that requirement so that instead of turning in 3 applications for what is functionally one CHA, they just have to turn in 1 application, which will reduce the paperwork on their end, make it easier to track on our end, generally just simplify the process for everyone. And we're looking at retaining the current 180-acre minimum size. We're going to update, proposing to update the boundary marking. Currently, it's every 300 feet. We have had comments that that's a little excessive for a lot of these properties, and so we're going to make it more consistent with also the CWMU rule, which is 300 yards, to still feel like it'll keep a CHA sufficiently marked, but kind of reduce some of the burden on the operators. We're also looking at updating the rule on how the pieces of property have to be arranged. Currently, for one CHA, it has to be a contiguous tract, so in one big piece. And we're looking at, again, removing that requirement for a contiguous tract. And again, this is kind of to reduce redundant paperwork. We have some CHAs that are, for example, a corner to corner with two sections or separated by a road, which under the current rule would have to be broken into two separate commercial hunting areas, even though they're effectively operating as a single commercial hunting area. So we're looking at allowing, as long as they're under the acreage cap, they would just have to have all the properties within a 10-mile diameter circle. And I've got just a few examples of how that could be laid out here. That leftmost example would just be one big block that's up against the acreage cap. And then the next one over would just be examples of how it could be broken up into multiple pieces as long as they fit within that greater area. If they were further apart, like in that third example over, where they wouldn't fit or be contained within that 10-mile diameter circle, then they would have to apply as two separate CHAs. And that fourth one over is just kind of a more realistic example of how they end up on the landscape, where currently that commercial hunting area might be three separate commercial hunting areas. Under the proposed changes, that operator could just turn in a single application instead of three. Under the current rule, there's a provision for season extensions. Granted that the season extension doesn't interfere with breeding wildlife, that basically the conditions are never really met, so that the season extension provision is never used. We're looking at removing that, basically to remove confusion. It's never used. We can't really ever prove it. So I don't want to waste people's time having it there and having people apply and ask for it. As far as the application dates, under the current rule, we have a single application period each year. We'd like to move that to rolling applications, where if a new operator is getting going, they can turn in their application any time of the year and we can get it processed, so that they know that they'll be permitted for the following season rather than having to wait until the season's almost started to actually receive their permit. And then we had a little bit of inconsistency with shooting hours, where if CHA was next to a waterfowl management area, they would be following basically waterfowl shooting hours. Proposing a change where the commercial hunting areas shooting hours would be just consistent with these resident game birds, regardless of location in the state. And also looking at adding disease requirements of avian influenza and mycoplasma. These diseases weren't really prevalent when the rule was originally written. Avian influenza has come up as a pretty big deal and a pretty big potential threat to commercial poultry industry. So we want to minimize risk as much as we can and be consistent with other rules as far as avian disease testing requirements. We're proposing to add avian influenza and mycoplasma to disease testing requirements if the poultry source is from a non-NPIP facility. So most CHAs source their day-old chicks or their eggs from NPI, Natural Poultry Improvement Plan, certified facilities. But if they're not coming from an NPIP facility, before release, they would need to be disease tested for avian influenza, mycoplasma, and salmonella. Also looking at proposing some changes on reporting. As the rule currently is, they're required to report both hunters and harvest and release birds by date. We're looking to change that recording requirement towards season, so that we really just need to know basically the scale of the operation. So we're proposing to kind of reduce that burden on the operators and just require reporting by season rather than by date. And then also require mortality reporting for unusual mortality events due to sickness, disease, bad feed, or unknown cause, rather than requiring all mortality or all mortalities to be reported. Just a lot of time in the normal operation and raising of game birds, you have some percent of mortality just from natural causes. So we're kind of reducing that requirement of reporting all the mortality and only asking for reporting on unusual events that could have disease implications. And also requiring immediate reporting for those unusual mortality events, basically so we can get out in front of a disease outbreak or a situation where you've got bad feed killing birds. So, and then there's a few just additional wording revisions that clarify but don't change the meaning of the rule.
All right, thank you. Questions from the rack?
You have a question.
Yep.
What's the occurrence of some of these facilities coming up disease laden regularly?
I don't have data on that, but we, as far to date, I'm not aware of any big outbreaks in Utah. But going to some of the Game Bird Grower Association meetings and talking to our veterinarian, we have seen disease outbreaks in other parts of the country and the world, and it's basically trying to get out in front of it a little bit.
Because you mentioned the transmission of disease from these pen-raised birds to the poultry industry. Have you seen that transmission occur with, like, in adjacent waterfowl management areas or native species that are already on the landscape? Or why, you just mentioned poultry, so I just wondered why you singled that out.
Well, I guess I singled out the poultry industry specifically because it's a relatively low probability of occurrence but high consequence. So there have been avian influenza outbreaks in other parts of the world that have been pretty devastating to poultry industry in certain places, and it's economically a pretty large industry in Utah. So we're basically trying to be consistent with other poultry game bird growing industry standards to have some of those same disease testing requirements.
And have you found operators to be pretty good about self-reporting when outbreaks occur?
Again, we haven't had major outbreaks. They do report on the annual report, but usually that's delayed anywhere 5-6 months from when it occurs to when it report back. Like just for one example, last year there was a number of growers that received bad feed. So we had at least a few growers that had die-offs due to bad feed, and it also affected our day-old chick program. So if we had immediate reporting on that and communicated that to the Department of Ag, potentially have got out in front of that and prevented additional losses.
Thanks.
I have one quick question. So last RAC meeting, we so eloquently heard how farmers and ranchers and the division work together. But you just stated that sharptail hens can look like pheasant hens. So are there any circumstances where you don't allow a CHA to occur because they could impact the sharptail grouse that occur on mostly private lands?
Typically, when looking at a new CHA that is in an area that overlaps with one of our native grouse species, we might put some additional restrictions on that CHA where they're either rooster only or putting streamers on the hens. Or
have you ever, do we have anything like that currently, or is that just a plan going now?
We do have some CHAs that have rooster only type restrictions.
Okay, thanks.
Historically, I grew up as a pheasant hunter. My father hunted pheasants, but I've hunted in the howl hunt up north for many, many years. And what I've seen is consistently is that what started out as a unit that was kind of, as per your description, now is pretty much a patchwork quilt of private properties integrated with, and so the 300 yard marking of those properties, I mean, some of those properties, those private properties where pheasant hunters are excluded, you know, may not even be a couple of, you know, the corners maybe, you know. It's just such a mess now from what it was years ago. So how do y'all plan on dealing with that kind of a situation where what it started out to be a single thing is now just people are bailing out right and left because they don't want to be involved in the CHA.
I guess if people were bailing out of the CHA and they didn't meet the acreage requirements, and they would no longer
permitted. They're releasing 600. It's a rooster only, but they're releasing 600 roosters in howl every year, I think, something like that. So the area is huge, but it's just a patchwork quilt.
I can't help but wonder if you're confusing a CHA with like a management unit.
Yeah, so these are commercial areas where someone would pay to go hunt and pay for released birds.
This is a pheasant farm.
A pheasant farm.
Oh, sorry, me bad.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, seeing none, comment or a motion?
Since I'm guilty, I'll make the motion. Be bad. Yeah, I motion that we support the whole disease, the whole thing.
I'll second.
Except for the disease thing.
Okay, so we have a motion by Danny to approve as presented, and a second by Steve. Any discussion? All in favor? Passes unanimous. All right, we'll move on to sage grouse translocation proposal.
All right, this is the greater sage grouse population augmentation for the Sheeprock sage grouse management area. Just for a little background on sage grouse in general and the sage grouse in the Sheeprocks. So we've been following sage grouse populations since the late 50s with let counts year to year. So we've got a pretty good long-term record of our populations. And over that time period, we can see a consistent 9 or 10 year cyclic behavior of the population, with kind of a overall long-term slightly downward trend. Due to this long downward trend, they've been proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act a number of times. However, in the latest decision in 2015, they're not warranted, and that was primarily because of all the proactive conservation measures that both Utah and other states have done. In Utah, that's including all our WRI watershed restoration initiative projects, improving habitat, the research we've done to better understand the populations within the state, and developing both our management plan and our conservation plan for the species. If you look at that graph there, you can see in the blue, that's our statewide population. So you can kind of see that regular cyclic behavior of the population. If we extended it out, you'd see that same curve going back. And then that orange line is the Sheep Rocks sage-grouse management area. And that kind of 2012, 2013, or 2011, we hit kind of that last trough in the population where we expect the population to start going back up. And that's what it did in all of our sage-grouse population or sage-grouse management areas, except for the Sheep Rocks. And in the case of the Sheep Rocks, we saw that population to continue to decline after what should have been the trough, and it should have been going back up. In response to that, the state initiated quite a bit of habitat work in the area, up to the predator control, and also initiated some sage-grouse transplants. So we, 3 years ago, proposed to the RACN board to add the Sheep Rock sage-grouse management area as a sage-grouse translocation site, which was approved. And since then, we've moved 120 birds, so 90 females and 30 males, over the course of 2016, 17, and 18. With the habitat work, predator control, and these population augmentations, we've seen the trajectory of that population change, and now is going back up. We're planning on to continue to do habitat work out there, continue predator control, and are proposing to do up to 5 years of additional transplants. And also this last year we found a new lek out there, which I hadn't found one in quite a while. So for this proposal, we're just requesting the board to approve an additional 5 years extension for the translocation release site of the Sheep Rocks sage-grouse management area. So the proposal is for the whole area, but where the birds would actually be released would be on a currently active lek within the sage-grouse management area. Since it's a state-sensitive species, there's a few additional requirements we need to go through translocation relative to other upland game species. So we need a management plan, which is in place. We've got a 2009 management plan. We have to put the proposal through the RDCC, the Resource Development Coordinating Committee. And that was posted on the RDCC website, and we did not receive any comments. And then the final step is Wildlife Board and RAC approval. So just looking at taking birds from either the Box Elder sage-grouse management area or the Parker Mountain sage-grouse management area and moving those to the Sheep Rocks. Those two populations are genetically similar. They're both robust populations. Those are two of our hunted populations, so we've got large, stable populations there. And they're also geographically close, which logistically makes the transplant possible. So we're just proposing to transport and release up to 40 sage grouse per year on the Sheep Rock sage grouse management area. And it's up to, so we plan on evaluating each year. We've currently got a research project going, and that'll be going for another year, collaring resident birds and collaring transplanted birds, and then that will continue another year or more, simply monitoring the birds that were already collared out there. Thank you.
All right, questions from the RAC. Danny.
Yeah, I just have one. You know, we had up there Clark's Fork in that general area, Raft River, right? We had a pretty significant fire up there. Will that influence your moving birds from up there down to the Sheep Rocks?
You're talking about the fire came over from Nevada?
Yeah.
Yeah, if you map that fire relative to our leks, it actually missed all of the leks and most of the brooding and winter habitat. So we're not anticipating a huge impact to the sage-grouse population. Where we're typically trapping them is off of the Park Valley side.
Okay.
Is there any evidence that these translocated grouse incorporate into the population very well?
They seem to be. We see a few on leks. It seems like most of the birds being counted on leks are not just the translocated birds. So it seems we seem to be actually changing the trajectory in the population rather than just dumping birds out there to augment our counts.
I thought I'd read in the literature that the biggest thing was the predator control. Is that true or not? I don't.
I would say it is generally not. When you get very low populations like we had out in the Sheeprock, pretty much each bird starts to matter more and more. So we've got demographic stochasticity where just these small dips can push it to zero. So predator control can be more important with these small populations, but generally improving habitat.
Habitat, but of the things that you've mentioned.
So with these small populations, kind of doing everything we can, but in a longer term, larger scale perspective, habitat work and having sufficient cover is so that the birds can naturally avoid predators is more important than our active predator control. Is that what you're asking?
I've got it. Go ahead. I was just going to ask you, what about these small groups of sage hens that are out? For instance, west of Nephi and in Mills and out west of Eureka. They seem to be getting more and more out west of Eureka and easier to find. Is there any plans to do anything out that way?
We don't currently have any plans based on those populations. I guess I'd have to look at a map seeing exactly what bird you're talking about, but I believe those would be outside of a SGMA. So our efforts are focused within. Jason might know where you're talking about a little better.
Jason Robinson, I'm the Upland Game Coordinator. The birds out in that area, the East Tinnick Mountains up there west of Nephi, those are outside of our sage-grouse management areas. So the governor's office a few years ago put together a conservation plan for sage-grouse where we tried to focus our conservation efforts on specific populations. The Sheeprock population is an SGMA, a sage-grouse management area. The East Tinnicks are not in a sage-grouse management area. So we're focusing most of our effort in the Sheeprocks. The East Tinnick birds seem to be doing well. The habitat hasn't changed that much, but most of our conservation efforts are directed to the Sheeprocks.
Hey, I have a question for you. In order for a lek to be a lek, it's got to be active for 3 years. So you're saying the new lek has been active 16, 17, and then this last year in 18. Is that correct?
No. We need to be active for 2 years. And the new lek we found last year wouldn't be incorporated into the data set as a
new lek
until we count it this year.
I've got a question.
Go ahead.
Go back to your population graph there that showed Sheeprock and the state. Yeah. Where things start going out of phase there in about, what, is that 2011, 12-ish?
Yeah, 12, 13.
Do you ever expect that Sheeprock sage-grouse population to come back into phase with the state?
Or external
influences that would keep it out of phase?
I would guess that if we get it back to a healthy population, those same factors that are influencing the rest of the populations in the state would influence the Sheeprocks in the same way, and it probably would go back in sync.
So then you can categorize what those external forces are.
We don't have a great idea of what is driving the cycles in sage-grouse populations.
I think it's funny Ken brought up the same thing I was going to talk about. So you have a population of birds west of Nephi that is doing really well. And so can you use that as a population to translocate out of, or does it have to be a dedicated?
We could potentially use that population to translocate out of. I think it's still a relatively small, low-density population relative to the larger populations in Box Elder and then on Parker Mountain that we are translocating out of.
And those birds specifically, they're probably too close to the sheeprock population. So if we moved them, they would very likely just fly right back. And so that's why we like to take them from a greater distance to make sure that they stay where we want them to stay.
All right, I don't see any other questions. Discussion or motion?
Any? Not a motion, but just one comment. You know, one thing that was left out, you know, Robbie Edgel is doing some work out there to try to improve, you know, riparian habitats and stuff with beaver analogs and the like. And we've been involved with him on that. And I think that that's really exciting. So is that, it's more of a question. So you because you didn't mention it, is that not as important, that kind of, if you will, in-stream habitat work?
I guess I didn't go through, I mentioned that we have done quite a bit of habitat work out there, but I didn't go specifically into all of the projects out there.
That's primarily aimed at chicks, right? I mean, at young birds.
So most of the acreage, most of the work we've done out there is PJ reduction. So when we take out PJ trees there, you basically get instant habitat. So sage grouse will avoid sagebrush habitat at pretty low levels of cover, so at 4% PJ cover, you'll pretty much exclude all sage grouse. So by removing trees from some of these lower density areas where we've got remaining understory grass forbs and sagebrush, are kind of create instant habitat. And then in addition to those, we've been doing some of those beaver dam analogs, which help raise the water table and should create quite a bit more of those kind of green groceries that are very important for broods, both the green plants growing and also all the insects associated with that. And we've got a backup slide here. So there's all the WRI projects that have taken place in the sheeprocks.
Question.
Yep.
Is there ever a time you say it's not worth it for 20 mils? Or do you just keep trying?
Yeah. So we're working on a revision to our conservation plan, and we will address that in that plan. But it is not complete yet.
I'm just asking philosophically. I don't know the answer either.
I think there is a point where you are throwing good money after bad, but
Jason Robinson. Essentially, the conservation plan that the governor's office came out with tried to address that very question. What populations should we focus in on, and what populations? So we have populations of sage grouse that are outside these sage grouse management areas, where that very question was addressed of can we save this population or not? And so a good example would be there's birds in the Park City Valley that are not within a sage-grouse management area because of the you know, housing developments going in that area. The sheeprock population, this question was asked, and ultimately the decision was made to continue to put conservation efforts towards it. And this proposal that the division's bringing forward is part of that plan.
Perfect. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments or ready for a motion if anybody would like to throw one out there?
I'll make a motion that we accept the division's proposal as given.
Okay, motion by Ken to approve as presented.
Yeah, and I'll second it.
Second by Danny. Any discussion? All in favor? Passes unanimously. Okay, that wraps up our agenda. Have a good holidays, good Christmas, and we'll see you guys next year.